Bylon is our bio-based, biodegradable, recyclable thermoplastic polymer. And so what that means from a technical side is we can use the exact same infrastructure, the exact same machines that are used to make nylon or polyester fibers to make Bylon. We make 80 million tons of these fibers, and so we know it's technology that can scale.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, where we interview the top climate tech founders and investors to share their stories, advice, and lessons when it comes to building and investing in climate. It's a pretty well-known fact that aluminum is infinitely recyclable, essentially the holy grail of circularity. Well, our guest today aims to do just that for threads or fibers. Oliver Chaffat, the CEO and founder of Siloom Labs, a generator accelerator participant, is in the process of scaling up an agriculture waste-to-fibers business. He's very early, which I found insightful because we got to see under the hood of an early-stage deep tech startup. You might be surprised at how it looks. If you love to nerd out about full circularity and fiber space, this is a great episode for you. And if you haven't already, please take a moment to fill out our listener survey. It only takes a few minutes, but it helps us massively to tailor the show to your liking. Enjoy the episode.
All right, Oliver, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Really excited to have you on. Fiber and decarbonizing that space is not something we get to talk about that often. So really, really happy to be talking with you today. Just give us a quick rundown. What do you do today?
So I'm the founder of Siloom Labs, and we make Bylon, which is our circular fiber for apparel and other applications. That's what we're doing, is we're trying to sort of actually make a scalable, sustainable solution to the apparel industry, which is difficult, to say the least.
Hey there. Are you building a climate tech business and looking for very specialized talent? Consider reaching out to our sponsors, NextWave Partners. NextWave are experts in talent acquisition, recruitment, and retention across the climate tech, renewables, and ESG spaces globally. So if your team is growing or you're looking to make a career change yourself, feel free to reach out to NextWave at next-wavepartners.com or reach out to one of their consultants directly via their LinkedIn page.
I think one of the things that really stands out about fashion and apparel is it's a clear emission sector. There's really a lot of problems with it, but it's also not that easy to tackle despite how big of a market it is. So I'd love to just hear what your thoughts on how big of a market it really is and why is it so difficult?
I think that it's incredibly difficult, but I would say it's probably just as difficult as all the other industries. It's not necessarily as big or as flashy as like cars or planes or something like that. And I would say that we don't really necessarily think about it as much, or at least I never did before I got into the industry. So at Siloom Labs, we're making fibers. And so I'd sort of think about the industry as the fibers. So that's like the polyester, the cotton, the nylon, the wool that goes into your clothes, right? And so, that industry, we make over 100 million tons of fibers for apparel every year. And that's just for apparel. And, a little over half of that is polyester, then you have cotton, and then you sort of go down from there. And so it's a huge amount of material. And, 100 million tons isn't a number that I can like comprehend. So I've done the back of the envelope calculation. And if you think about just synthetic textiles, so like your nylon, your polyester, your acrylic, you make over the equivalent of 20 747s worth of synthetic textiles every hour, like globally. So, we're making a ton of fibers. And so, one challenge is we have to replace that amount of fibers with something else, right? Because, and it's a huge amount, right? But then another challenge is that, the industry is incredibly fragmented and, we don't necessarily know where our fibers come from. And there are great reports on this. And, everybody talks about, the transparency, and transparency is going to be key across sort of the climate sector. But that's especially true in, the apparel industry as well. And I think that that also makes it hard for brands, to choose better, solutions, for example. It's an incredibly complex and fragmented industry that also is at scale, right? And people don't think about it because you don't really think about where your clothes come from.
I think being, within Climate VC myself, I see a lot of attention going towards circular economy, reusing fibers, reusing materials. There's also now what you're talking about, which is a creation of those materials and tackling it from that side. So how did this side of the problem come on your radar?
Yeah, so I'm a chemist by training, and so I got my PhD from Caltech, and so I'm like a super nerd, right? And I spent, 6 years in the sub basement of in Southern California, and right, that was my happy spot in Southern California, not the beach, right? So that tells you a little bit about me. But so I moved to Japan right after, and that's I worked for a biotech, and I started making fibers, and I really liked it personally because we had this like physical thing that I was like making after designing it, on the computer or whatever, right? And then I got reading about the science of it, and like as a science nerd, I'm just like, there's so much cool physics and chemistry and engineering that goes into making fibers. And so that got me really excited and really wanting to, make fibers. And that's sort of how I got at it because like I'm not fashionable. I don't care about that. Like, it's sort of like not at all. It's comical to me that I sort of operate in the fashion space because like I like this shirt that I'm wearing is over 10 years old and I bought off of like Nordstrom's Rack, like at like, a heavily discounted, which maybe also speaks towards the problem that I just wasn't aware of initially, right? And so that's sort of how I got into it. And it's just sort of I really like the fibers and the science behind it, but also I was just absolutely shocked by the scale of it and how, nobody is really willing to compromise because frankly speaking, the fibers we make are really good and really cheap, whether it's polyester or cotton. And, brands have a fiduciary responsibility, most brands do, to their shareholders, and that's to make the most amount of money, right? And so, I think that what we need to do, there's a lot of talk around recycling, right? And I think that's incredibly good because we've already put a lot of energy into making that material. So if we can not have to completely discard that and then put that amount of energy in again is much more bet is much better on in terms of like footprint, right? But practically speaking, like less than 1% or 1% of clothing gets recycled back to clothing, right? It's often downcycled or recycled polyester often comes from the bottle industry. And now the bottle industry wants their clothing back or their bottles back. And so we have to find a different way. And so,
Right.
we need to make the material not using oil, but also not using significant amounts of other resources. And, that we need to, for example, grow food, because while I think we all need clothing, I think I would argue we all need food more than we need clothing. And so we need to make sure that we're
Right.
not sort of disrupting that as well. And it's an interesting problem. I mean, it's like, how do we basically replace a perfect material that is cheap and really high performing and really
Right.
versatile with something that's better? And it's just, I mean, it's challenging, and that's sort of, I like it.
The bottom line is a major concern. The usability is a major concern. Siloam Labs, your name to fame. I think this is a perfect transition. You call it Bylon. So what is Bylon?
Bylon came out of, a night of few too many tall boys of PBR, and I was like, oh, but I did have the wherewithal to write it down on my phone, and so I at least it wasn't that many PBRs. So Bylon is our bio-based, biodegradable, recyclable thermoplastic polymer, and so I think the coolest technology to me is it's a thermoplastic. And so what that means from a technical side is we can use the exact same infrastructure, the exact same machines that are used to make nylon or polyester fibers to make Bylon. We make 80 million tons of these fibers, and so we know it's technology that can scale. Basically, all you do is you put in a solid, you heat it up, you push it out tiny holes, and you get your yarns. I mean, that's effectively how synthetic fibers are made. And so it's incredibly land efficient, it's incredibly energy efficient, water efficient. So it's like it's the most efficient way to make fibers, and we know it can scale, and it's the cheapest too. And so that was sort of what I wanted to do in creating Bylon was make sure that we had a way to scale the fibers to the million, 10 million, 100 million ton, right? And I'm under no delusion that I'm going to be making 100 million tons next year, right? Like, but that technology exists. And I think that that was the key part, as well as being able to sort of have responsible sort of beginning and end of life characteristics, which is, also important.
So let's go back a little bit to the inspiration behind Bylon. Of course, you now have identified a problem. The technology is really cool. Was it easy to see that this is applicable in this case? Because I think you'll see a lot of people in climate, I think materials is a big discussion. new biodegradable biogenic materials for construction, for example, a lot of times you're looking at a blank slate, and it's actually pretty cool how AI is identifying, oh, this compound might work, this compound might work. I'm guessing you didn't go through that kind of process because you might have been your own genius in this matter, but how did you really go about identifying material to use case and scoping at that scale, like you said?
Yeah, I mean, I did not use AI, and I think that genius is probably way too generous of a term. Fool is probably foolhardy, maybe. So, I mean, literally how it started was I put my infant son at that point down to her toddler son down to bed, and then I would get on my computer and read 1930s patents and papers, just being like, okay, like there has to be a better way to do this. Like, what have we done in the past? And is there any inspiration that we can take from that? Like, a lot of the original polymers, you know, were made from bio-based feedstocks because we didn't actually have the oil or coal or petrochemical industry back in the 30s like we do today, right? And so they like took these monomers from bio-based feedstocks and they would make them. And, you know, there's a lot of development of polymers that was done. And, you know, I sort of started there and I'm like, okay, like, well, and also for me, you know, I came from a fiber, you know, textile apparel background, you know, for my professional life. And I'm like, you know, that's my experience. I'm like, okay, what's a polymer that could make a good fiber? And then, okay, maybe these four polymers could make a good fiber. Okay, let's read more. Okay, this one can be bio-based. Okay, maybe this one can't. This one is biodegradable. This one's not, you know, stuff like that. And I just sort of narrowed it down from there. And that's, you know, sort of how I came to the idea for what is now Bylon on paper, at least.
So you mentioned knowing polymers. Actually, I would love to hear at a high level. None of us are really experts here, but how or do you evaluate a polymer? How does that really work, especially here?
How do you evaluate? I mean, so you can think about it all you want in the, you know, on paper, in the cloud or whatever you want to call it, right? And I think there's no way to know until you actually make it and you test it. And, you know, we're sort of at that next phase where we can make a little bit of the yarn and we can do some tests, but really we need to make more so we can test more, right? But, you know, there are some, I mean, like chemical intuition, for lack of a better word, which is not necessarily my favorite sort of term, but like, you know, there are classes of polymers that behave better as fibers. And there are classes of polymers that behave better as like films, for example, right? And so you can sort of look at those general chemical underlying, you know, molecular structures, right? And be like, okay, like this is maybe going to be an okay fiber. Like, let's run with it.
So I'm kind of curious, when you were in your past role, were they not working on sustainable fibers, and they were just working on different kinds of fibers, and you're like, hey, this is crazy. I actually want to do something more sustainable? Because I wanted to understand the transition. If you were already working in sustainable fibers, why start your own company?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, you know, hubris maybe. no, I mean, so I was in fibers, I was running the fiber R&D team, doing sustainable fibers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sort of comes back to the scale thing. And it's just, can we make enough fibers? Because we need to have scalable technology in order to have adoption, because the costs need to go down. But also, we need to have scalable technology in order to make significant positive environmental impacts. And I think that something that frustrated me was I saw a limitation to the lack of scale in the process. And it was coupled with a bunch of other stuff, you know, personal and other professional things. And I moved back from Japan to the States, and that's, you know, sort of when I was like, okay, like I'm going to start my own company, or at least, you know, give it the old college try.
And did you like have any like major, I guess, I always like to understand the gap between, you know, having a job and then going to start your own thing. Was there a lot of hesitation there where you're just kind of like, you know what, I'm going to do this. And there was, it just kind of sent it straight. I want to understand how you went from not doing it to doing it, that gap.
Yeah. I mean, you know, It was coupled with a lot of like, I moved across the world. I was resettling. You know, I'm based in Oklahoma City area right now. I didn't actually grow up here. And so like, there was the culture shock of like moving back to the States after 5 years and moving to a new city. You know, I grew up on the West Coast, and so it was very different. And I think that there's just all of these things that made it just be like, oh, like it was just another thing, right? Like these are all very large life sort of things. And it's like, oh yeah, I guess I'm like starting a company now. And, you know, it's sort of started out, I was shocked how easy you can like form an LLC by like typing a few buttons on, you know, in a form, like typing, you know, into a form online. I'm like, okay, I have an LLC. And then I'm like, all right, like, I guess I'm going to do this. And so, you know, I spent some time, you know, on the computer, like reading like all of the blogs that are like, how to start your own company and stuff like that. I'm like, okay, I think I can do this. And so it just sort of was like a thing that happened while, you know, I also was undergoing a lot of other major life changes.
How did you fund it? Like, how did you get the funding to continue? I'm assuming at some point you raised money. I just want to understand, like, you know, because it sounds like you didn't necessarily plan to do this, but there has to be funding to make it work.
Yeah. So So in Japan, you know, I worked in Japan for almost 5 years. We paid into the Japanese pension system. They actually, if you work a certain amount of time and under a certain amount of time, you can take your pension out as a lump sum. Ah. And so I got a lump sum of my pension back, and my wife did too. And so that was sort of our bootstrapping, you know, like I obviously had some very serious conversations with my wife about this, and, you know, it, you know, like, okay, this is like the amount of money we're comfortable putting in ourselves. Yeah. And, you know, and so put in some money, and then a friend of mine who's a professor, like, let me come and work in his lab on the down low. He's a chemistry professor, and he like let me like come and use like his equipment and work on the lab on the down low to like make the original material and like sort of suss out the idea of like, is this polymer like tractable? And, you know, that I was like, okay, like I guess it, you know, it might be. And then so that's sort of like how we initially got started. And then, you know, sort of with the bootstrapping, I was able to do the first proof of concept or MVP or whatever you want to call it, right? And, you know, I was able to make the material, and then I was able to turn that material into, you know, melt process it, right? So I was able to like push it out a melt processing machine and get, you know, something that doesn't really look, I mean, like 3D printing filament, but like super like not even. And then, you know, and then with that, I was able to raise a little bit of angel money from a friend of mine, which was, you know, I mean, he was our first, you know, investor, and that really gave us a little bit of breathing room. And, you know, it's all gone into just sort of pushing the technology. You know, I mean, everybody's like, oh, you got to get to your MVP. Well, it's not really, you don't have one MVP. You have like your first one, and then your second one, then your third one, then your fourth one, right? Especially I find in lab. And then, you know, we also were part of then that led us to being accepted to the Generator Accelerator in Oklahoma City in the first cohort. And, you know, sort of like a little bit of steps. Like these are,
At the early stage with something like this, what is the major cost, right? Is it just renting a lab? Is that the cost? Or are there a lot of other like major costs initially while you're doing R&D?
I mean, it's all R&D costs. You know, I found, we have some really good consultants that have been amazing. And, you know, and I mean, that's where all of our money basically goes. I mean, we have like the Google G Suite or whatever, right? But that's like $12 a month or something like that. I mean, you know, it's all R&D, you know, I mean, we have to buy the material, we have to test the material, you know, and it's not like cheap necessarily to do this. And there isn't
I'm just always curious because, you know, people talk about this, and if you don't work in a lab and you're not doing this stuff, it's kind of like super unknown, like what your actual costs are, right? A tech startup is one thing because you're like, oh, gotta have software and pay people, right? That's about it. But this is good. So I appreciate you kind of giving some transparency there and helping us understand that. I'm really curious to just get into the tech a bit more. So obviously we're not experts at this, right? So can you kind of explain, very broadly speaking, how does this technology work? I want to understand the conventional and then what you're doing. So X raw material is done this too, and then this happens, and then it becomes, you know, it's sold to the person who then turns it into clothing. Can you just walk us through that process and then how you're different?
Yeah. So traditional, we'll do synthetic, and we can do cotton as well. So we get oil out of the ground, and, you know, this is a tangent, but, you know, people are always like, oh, we used to use all of the like sheep or whatever back in the day. Well, I mean, we use all of the oil that we suck up out of the ground. We use every single last microliter of it. So like we're really good at using that resource, but we take oil out of the ground, we do some chemistry on it, and then we make polyester that's then made, you know, made into a yarn that yarn is then, or the polyester could be made into bottles. Like, people don't necessarily realize this, but your like pop bottles are the same material that your like clothing is. So that's, you know, always interesting. It's the same polymer. So yeah, so we make yarns. That yarn is often sold to somebody who then does one, you know, one value added thing onto it, who then passes it down the chain, and eventually it is, you know, branded, and you can go into your store and buy a t-shirt, for example. Cotton, you know, is a little bit different where we're growing it, right? And so, you know, we have your farmers, you're putting a lot of pesticides, water, fertilizer, all of that stuff. You grow the cotton, it goes, you know, gets ginned, it gets, you know, spun into yarn, and then it sort of is the same, right? And you can always, you can mix and match, sort of. You can mix cotton and polyester, which is very commonly done. So, you know, what we're doing is we are taking, you know, agricultural waste. So, you know, something, you know, that is a byproduct of large industrial agriculture, at bioethanol ferment, like, you know, production. So for sustainable air fuel, you know, they have a huge waste stream. And so we can take that. Chicken feathers, for example, is another one that we could theoretically take. So we take that and then we put it in a pot. We, you know, do our little like chemistry on it. And then we do that a few times, and then we make a polymer that is Bylon. And so we're doing chemistry. We're not doing like synthetic biology. We're not doing fermentation. We're doing just chemical reactions using standard. Well, right now we're doing like 5-gallon buckets, literally, which is great because 5-gallon buckets are a lot cheaper than like reactor vessels, and also, you know, sort of proves the scalability. So we make basically a polymer that then can drop into the exact same downstream processing as polyester or nylon or cotton, right? Where, you know, we make a yarn just like we would with polyester or nylon. And then, you know, we made one yarn right now, and then we dropped it into a standard knitting machine and it knit up. And then I dyed it on the stove with my, you know, 5-year-old son. And then I put it in my washer and dryer because we're Americans and we wash and dry, and, you know, it's like, right. And so the point is that, like, we, you know, we're using, like, we're combining sort of the best of both the synthetic and natural fibers, where we're using bio-based, renewable, but waste feedstocks, which is important. But we're doing highly efficient chemistry that has the infrastructure out there that can scale, that doesn't take a lot of energy. And, you know, so it's sort of like the feedstocks are sort of natural, but then the chemistry is all sort of similar to the synthetics. And then it drops in, you know, to the same, you know, infrastructure that's there. And I think that that's incredibly important, primarily to keep costs down, which will then drive adoption, right? Because it's, you know, frankly speaking, it's all cost related, mostly.
Right.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
And so I think it's very clear to see there's some retrofitting going on. The sustainability of it, I think, is going to be really cool to see where that comes from. Before we get there, I mean, one aspect of it is definitely the retrofitting of the waste, like you mentioned, from, you know, agriculture and then other sources. I want to walk through your experience so far and maybe what you're thinking going ahead about sourcing that. Has it been an easy process? Has it been something that you have to think about? What is that like, and how does that factor into the growth of this material?
Yeah, I mean, it has not been an easy process. Like, it's not something that I am at all sort of have experience in, or, you know, have done in the past. You know, thankfully, you know, I'm in the state of Oklahoma. It's incredibly, you know, agriculture is a very large part of the economy here, all throughout the plains. Industrial ethanol production is also huge in the plains as well. And so, you know, there is that like locale, which is very nice. And so I've started to, you know, talk with some of the people at, you know, the local like farm board and everything like that to try to figure out how to do this. But like, I can like go online and, you know, buy chicken feathers or whatever, right? Like, that is something that I can do right now. But, you know, going forward, like, we need to do this at scale. And so I need to talk with those people who understand that. And that's, you know, definitely something that is out of sort of my comfort zone or experience.
Got it. So there's not an existing necessarily massive supply chain for these alternative feedstocks, is what you're saying?
I think it's out there. I just don't think I know where it is yet. I mean, this is like a commodity that is traded for, like, the Like it is a commodity that is traded. And, you know, I can like Google, like you can look up a price and it might even be on like the USDA website. Like the USDA has like commodity prices for very common
stuff.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay.
But I just don't,
you just gotta, you just gotta find a person who's trading and he'll know who ships it around. But, okay. Interesting. So that's pretty fascinating. We could probably talk about supply chain more, but it sounds like it's there. It's just a matter of like getting plugged into the system and getting that infrastructure, which is usually not connected to making clothing or fibers. They're just disconnected currently, right? You just got to couple them up. But I want to understand in your process, what aspect makes it sustainable? So you said it's better with energy. I'm assuming there's a bit better with water usage. Like, how is it more sustainable in what specific ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it depends on how you define sustainability, right? And, you know, I want to be fully transparent. We don't have a preliminary LCA. Like, we're still a little bit too early to even for even that to be possible or informative in the future. That's something that we're looking at doing this year. You know, I think that how I've looked at that right now is, you know, we can use waste as a feedstock, which is good, what they call a Gen 2, you know, feedstock. And so we're not taking away arable land. But, you know, if you look at LCAs of, for example, you know, clothing, right? If you look at the ones that have been published in, you know, academic journals, they compare polyester, nylon, you know, cotton, whatever. You see that like cotton, you know, is really good on sort of the feedstock front, right? Except for water usage, because it comes from, you know, bio-based renewable feedstocks, and, you know, nylon and polyester are not because they come from oil that we're digging up, right? So we're, you know, depletion of resources there. But then if you look downstream, you know, nylon, polyester have basically zero impact on, you know, have zero emissions, for example, for the yarn formation, right? And I think that that is because of the processing method, because it is incredibly efficient. You know, they don't use any water, stuff like that. And I think that that is sort of how I am looking at the sustainability. And then on the end of life, you know, we're designing recyclability into it, and we're working on that at Waste Lab on the lab scale, trying to, you know, establish that technology. But also sort of, I'm not an influencer. I'm not a fashion person. I'm not going to pretend that I can change how you behave with your clothes. And right now, almost all clothing is thrown away. And so I want to make sure that if or when it does end up in our environment, it doesn't stay there forever. And so, you know, it is also biodegradable. And I think that that's sort of how I'm thinking about it, right? We don't want it floating around, you know, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch for hundreds of years, right? And so that's sort of the other
aspect. Just to kind of put this in perspective, the first on the front end, you'll have more sustainable inputs because you're not having to grow them. These are kind of byproducts that are being wasted or probably used in some other cases, but generally they're waste. So it's already, you can see it as more sustainable. Yes, it was grown with water, but otherwise it'd be going to waste. You're taking that's more sustainable. You're putting it into a process which is already relatively sustainable, even in the conventional sense. Very low water usage. And energy usage is also quite low as well, it sounds like. Okay.
Yes, energy usage is really low.
And then so the big thing for you will be the output. So you're – now walk us through that. So you said it could be biodegradable or recyclable. Can you talk more about that? Is that the objective, is that you can basically turn it into the aluminum can of clothing so you can recycle it as many times as you want?
Yeah, I mean, that is what I see the apparel industry going towards is recyclability. You know, I think that we've had big recycling initiatives in a variety of different industries, and it really depends on where you are in the world, whether or not those are efficient. Or actually used, but you know, we do need to make sure that it can be recycled because, you know, that is so much less energy required to make it again, right? If we can take, you know, a Bylon t-shirt and make a new one out of it, we don't have to, you know, go through the microbes and then grow crops and, you know, take the waste from that and everything like that, right? So that's something that we're pursuing. You know, I think something that I'm particularly interested in is making sure that we can recycle it, but not downcycle it. So making sure that we get virgin grade material out of it. And so we're looking at some low hanging fruit sort of in the lab to, you know, establish some chemical recycling technologies that would be, you know, plug and play to sort of some other standard ones.
So that's the main next kind of figuring out is whether or not it can be fully recycled, because it sounds as though you've gotten the front end figured out where you can drop in without messing up the existing machinery, but now you're just identifying the back end. Can it be recycled?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the bigger unknowns. Okay. Right now, but we don't need to just focus on that. We can focus on many different parallel processes, right? So we can work on scaling up the front, making more fiber, but also, and that's completely decoupled from figuring out the recycling. And so I think that is, helpful to have those problems decoupled, but I want to establish that. And then, it is also, we need to do the certifications for biodegradability as well, which,
And then, so when you're building something like this, is this an IP play where you're going to get it figured out and then license it? Or do you aim to eventually become a producer of these materials?
That's a great question. And I don't have a good answer. So we are at this early stage, we're protecting IP from feedstock in to yarn out, as well as the recycling technology. I don't want to be an apparel brand. I don't want to make textiles. So we're not really touching sort of that intermediate space. So that's where our IP that we're developing and protecting, through your traditional means like patents and trade secrets. So that's what we're doing. We need to be able to produce, we need to have an R&D lab to be able to iterate and optimize. And that will likely lead to some small scale production, just because it's so easy to produce with these types of processes. Whether or not as we scale up, we produce ourselves or license is unknown. And I mean, I think that with the ability to sort of drop into existing machinery, it really allows us to license. And I think that might, also facilitate adoption and everything like that. But I think that is something that we don't know at this stage, but we're setting ourselves up to be able to
do it. Okay. Very good. Well, that makes sense. I think it's pretty clear then that, obviously the business model is kind of, there's a couple of paths forward. I think with a lot of these technologies, there's various possible ways. And I assume just like everybody else, you'll have to build a pilot that's large enough to demonstrate that the technology works. You can get the guarantees, et cetera. But I guess I think that, I mean, we've covered quite a lot. I guess one just kind of thing to wrap up here would be where do you see yourself going in the next couple, let's say next year? What's the biggest challenge you're chasing down and how are you tackling that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, all about scale, right? And so, we can make, 5 kilos today using, 5 gallon buckets. So we're trying to target 50 kilos next. And, it's actually because the plastics industry is so large, it's actually really hard to work with very small quantities. And so, if we get to 50 kilo, sort of scale batch, whatever you want to call it, we can now drop into the next sort of size up. So we go from an R&D sort of machinery to a semi-pilot machinery, right? And so that is nice just to sort of make sure that we're still, dropping in at these larger scales. It also provides us more material where we can sit and iterate and optimize and, improve our manufacturing process. But I really want to be able to make more so we can, learn more about the material, right? So we can make your standard textile, knit or woven textiles, do all the testing. How strong is it? How does it dye? How does it, behave, when you, next to skin, stuff like that. So we can really see the properties now, where we need to improve and, target sort of our initial, prototypes, right, to types of garments that it's suited for, right? Is it going to be a jacket, outdoor jacket? Probably not right away because we need super strong materials for that, but maybe it'll be a nice t-shirt or maybe it'll be a nice close to, a base layer or underwear or something like that. So that's what I'm really excited about, is just sort of scaling up and understanding what we have and what we need to improve and doing all of the sort of ancillary things. I think that at that point, we can start to run a preliminary LCA to see, our impact, but also where our hotspots are. So we can try to mitigate those as early as possible, right? And we need to start thinking about, end of life. And it's scaling up all of this technology, because if we can't make it, at scale and in a cheap way, then, right, it's not going to be adopted.
I think one thing, I know we're almost at the wrap up, but I think you mentioned one thing that I really want to tap into really quick, which is when it comes to actually figuring out and working on the pilot for something like this and setting yourself up for that, I think pilots within climate tech, within climate tech founders, are obviously very confusing. And a lot of it is because a lot of things we're seeing are new. So even the corporates and the partners haven't really figured out what they're looking for. I'm curious, before you even engage in these conversations, how are you thinking about the pilot? How are you thinking about pitching yourself? Of course, like you mentioned, there's improvements on the bottom line, there's reuse opportunities and things like that. But what really drives how you think you're going to walk into those pilot conversations?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that I have found it is very hard to pitch yourself as I am a replacement for X. I think that that's bad. I think that that is very hard because X, Y, and Z are incredibly good and cheap, right? Like nylon, polyester, cotton, wool are really good, really cheap, and we already know how to make it and use it at scale, right? And so I think that to some extent, you know, we can't do that. And I it's taken a while for me to learn that, but I definitely recommend you don't sort of narrow yourself into that corner. So, you know, when I talk to apparel brands or manufacturers, you know, it's like, okay, it's really, you know, and I talk to the like development team, like the material development team, right? And so I think that at that point, you know, we sort of often speak the same language, you know, we're polymer chemists or whatever, right? And so I'm like, all right, like I am making a melt processable fiber from agricultural waste. They're like, okay. And so, you know, I think that it's trying to position it so that they understand that, you know, our feedstock inputs are waste feedstocks as opposed to, you know, taking arable land. And that's a big thing, especially in the industry right now, is making sure that we have sustainable, scalable feedstocks. And then, you know, emphasizing to them that we're using standard chemistries and we're using standard, you know, manufacturing methods. So it will also drop in. We're only like changing the polymer. We're changing one wheel on this, you know, incredibly complex cog. And we can use your preferred spinner. We can use your preferred textile mill, right? And that's the point. It's like, we don't necessarily have to control all of that technology. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like I said, the more we know about our material, the easier that conversation becomes. Because I'm like, okay, it's this strength. It's, you know, it behaves like sort of like this for, you know, moisture, but it behaves like this other thing for abrasion, right? And so I think that that just helps that conversation. But, you know, I think that it's really, you know, emphasizing sort of that we can scale and that we have this new material that will be, you know, a good replacement.
So it sounds like in that case, then you're mostly referring to talking to strategics then, right? Not necessarily VCs, because the VCs may not, I mean, are they the ones who are against you saying we have a replacement for X, or is it the strategic?
No, that's definitely more like the brand side of things. You know, talking with VCs, you know, and I'm still learning this, right? I come from a very technical background. It's more about the money. It's more about, you know, sort of, okay, like, you know, this is like our cost right now. This is our cost, you know, at scale. I get this because, yeah, we like improve our yield a little bit, but also like here are the costs for these manufacturing processes that I found, or like, you know, stuff like that. And I think it's definitely driven by cost and just the plug and play drop in sort of ability of our, of our technology.
So, sorry, I know. So we're going to wrap, but I did have one more major question, which is there already substantial interest from the brands that from the clothing manufacturers? Like, is there demand to become more sustainable, even if you can't recycle what you're doing? If your feedstocks are, we didn't clarify this, but is it at scale going to be the same cost as kind of the conventional inputs?
Yeah, yeah. So I think that at scale, you know, our best sort of conservative estimates, you know, at scale, we can, you know, be at cost parity with conventional.
So given that circumstance, even if you didn't figure out the recyclability, is there still strong interest to do that, assuming that they can figure out the supply chain?
Yeah, I mean, the apparel companies have, a lot of apparel companies have made very public and very ambitious sustainability goals, and part of that is sourcing preferred materials, is a very generic term that a lot of people use, right? And so I think that part of that is switching from virgin materials, and that also includes virgin cotton, right, to, you know, more preferred materials like recycled materials or other new bio-based materials. And so I think that there is a lot of interest just from that, especially given our sort of our waste feedstock.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting. I guess I think back to what you said, just a comment on the companies needing to make money for their shareholders, right? I think we had I had a conversation a long time ago. I think it was like almost 2 years ago now with Rod James on kind of the idea of like, will companies ever seek more moderate profit, right? Rather than just selling as many things as possible. Again, that's like a whole discussion around structuring companies and things like that. But I don't think we're going to change that necessarily. Maybe that will change over time. But anyways, well, this is pretty fascinating. Obviously, really, really loved hearing about the new technologies and like hearing about the journey and how you get there, and excited to just continue following your path. But do you have any kind of final thoughts or where people can reach you?
Thank you. First, thank you for having me. It's been fun to have this conversation. The company is called Scilume Labs. That's SCI-LUMELABS.com. We're also on LinkedIn. Is primarily, I don't understand social media. So LinkedIn is like sort of my understanding of social media. We have a company there. And then we also do have an Instagram, which my main thing and my main love of that is Fiber Fridays, which we put out very infrequently, but on Fridays where I tell you about interesting fibers. My favorite is the muskox fiber. So this is like a cow looking thing that lives up in the Arctic, but they have really cool, really like soft fibers. But anyways, that's that's the fun thing that we do on Instagram, because I'm told that that is not acceptable on LinkedIn. Come to the website, you can learn more. You can email me. It's oliver@scilumlabs.com. If you ever are interested, but yeah, thank you again so much for having
absolutely.
Me.
Yeah, really absolutely. No, super glad to have you on. Thanks for coming on again. Super excited to see where we go. So you have a good rest of your day. Cheers.
Yep.
Thank you.
Bye.